It's great to have our United States Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut on with us. All those years he was a congressman, and he said he'd be with us when he was a senator, and he has kept his word, and we love him for it. Chris, thanks so much. What are you spending your time on these days?
I'm spending a lot of my time these days on trying to get a mental health bill through the Senate before the end of the year. There's a really short list of issues that could unite Democrats and Republicans in the Senate that we could get done into the president's desk. And, you know, as you know, our behavioral health system in Connecticut is badly, badly broken. Same story in most other states. And we've found some common ground. Myself and the conservative Tea Party aligned senator from Louisiana, Bill Cassidy, have written a massive comprehensive rewrite of the nation's mental health laws to put more resources into the system, to bring the physical health and mental health systems together, to pressure the insurance companies to cover more mental health treatment. And I am, as we speak, trying to negotiate with Senator McConnell and others to bring that bill to the floor. So, you know, when the election starts to bear down on you, this job gets a little bit tougher because there's not as much room for, you know, legislative work on the floor. But this is one of the few that could get done.
I wrote my PhD thesis on this very question of expanding mental health, community mental health centers. And what's the plan? I mean, what's the money that would be appropriated before?
Well, you know, I feel out of water knowing that you know 10 times as much as I do about this. But, the plan is first to recognize that we just have a fundamental deficiency of inpatient beds. We've actually lost 4,000 inpatient beds since the recession began. And so we have, just continued to warehouse the mentally ill in prisons and in emergency rooms because there's no place to put people that need, you know, not a long-term commitment, but a week or 2 week or 30-day commitment to stabilize. So our bill would provide more funding for institutions to open up more inpatient beds, and then we would also put more funding into outpatient reimbursement to try to draw more providers in. And then our bill sort of challenges states to really take a look at how they structure behavioral health and the rest of their healthcare system. In the 1960s, as a means of deinstitutionalizing the mentally ill, we built all of these community mental health centers. And, you know, that was a really revolutionary positive development. But in retrospect, it didn't really make sense to create a healthcare system for your brain over here and then a healthcare system for every other part of your body over there. We now know that the brain and the rest of the body are linked, and that, you know, people with mental illness are dying 20 years earlier because the rest of their issues don't get dealt with. And so part of our bill starts to incentivize states to bring their community mental health system back into the rest of the healthcare system, so that when you walk into a clinic, you've got your primary care physician and your psychologist right there in the same building rather than having to travel across town to get your whole body treated.
Chris, I wanted to ask you, if I may, what you make of the results of the primary results in Connecticut. I mean, there you are, you're a practicing politician. What do you make of the results, Hillary, Trump, and what it portends for our presidential race?
Well, I mean, at first, I think Tuesday's results were, likely the end of the competitive Democratic primary. I think everyone, including Bernie, acknowledges that Secretary Clinton is going to be the nominee, and while he's going to stay in the race, because he feels it's important to raise the issues that he's been raising, I don't think that he's going to be attacking her in the way that he has, and vice versa. And in Connecticut, we've been a contrarian state over the years when it comes to our, presidential primary results, going back to, 1992 when Jerry Brown beat then Governor Clinton in a big surprise. And so, I think it's a triumph in a sense for Secretary Clinton to win a state that hasn't always aligned itself with a front runner. But Senator Sanders did well here. Bernie did well, and I think that speaks to, a lot of people in this country who are done with incremental change, who may not actually believe that Bernie can deliver everything that he says, but are willing to take a chance because the only thing more unrealistic than, what Bernie is offering is the continued trajectory of their economic life. And so they need something big to change. And I think that that's the message from this whole primary season, is that Americans, you know, Americans need a little bit of an economic revolution with this next administration. And Washington's not necessarily built for that. Congress isn't necessarily built for that. But that, I think, is the message that's being sent on both sides of the aisle.
And do you think Hillary is committed to doing that, to delivering that? Or do you think she's part of the problem?
No, I think she's committed to it, and frankly, I don't think she gets enough credit for some of the very specific plans that are radical that she's put on the table. I mean, you know, just a year or two ago, you know, Governor Malloy was being, you know, chided for being so far outside of the national mainstream by moving forward with paid medical leave. Well, now that's a mainstream idea in this country, and Hillary Clinton's adopted it as part of her economic platform. Read her tax plan. It's a revolutionary tax plan that fundamentally puts you know, billions of dollars back into the hands of the middle class. So, you know, she, you know, maybe doesn't talk in the revolutionary and radical way that Bernie Sanders does, but she actually has more concrete, you know, major ideas as part of her campaign, reform ideas, than Bernie does. And I think she's serious about them.
You have a chance, do not, to take back the Senate. And if that happens, what difference will that make?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, it'll make a difference in terms of the future trajectory of the Supreme Court. You know, we obviously know that we've got one vacancy that will likely last into the next Congress. And if there's a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president, then I think you will see a swift confirmation of a judge. I would hope that a Democratic Senate would take a look at rules changes. We came very close to changing the rules of the Senate in 2013 when I got here, and I think this filibuster, this idea that 40 members of the Senate can block any piece of legislation from moving forward, is very undemocratic, and so I would hope that that would be part of our agenda. And so, you know, I think there's a number of things that would come with Democrats being in charge of the Senate. Obviously, you know, we'll be, you know, working on helping to implement the Paris Accords, being serious about global warming. We'll take a shot at raising the minimum wage. So, you know, I think it'll be a very active Democratic majority. Now the Senate may become Democratic, but the House, you know, less likely. And so, you know, you'd still have the problem of divided government in Washington.
So what would it mean for you? Would you become the chairman of a specific committee?
I would likely become chairman of a subcommittee. I don't know which one that would be. I wouldn't become chairman of a full committee. You normally have to wait, you know, a full term until you get that opportunity. But I'd certainly likely be chairman of a subcommittee or two. And you know, my power and influence certainly would be elevated if Democrats were in charge.
I believe we looked this up. I think you're the second youngest guy in the Senate. What does that mean? Do people treat you like a youngster, or is age irrelevant?
I mean, you know, age is a little bit irrelevant once you get to the U.S. Senate. I mean, I think there's an assumption that you've done something right politically in order to win a Senate seat, and so people don't pay much attention to age. But you know, it's nothing new for me. I was the youngest member of the Connecticut House of Representatives, the youngest member of the U.S. of the State Senate, one of the youngest members of the Congress. So I've always been the youngest guy in the room, and you know, I embrace it. I work on issues that matter to the younger generation because I do feel a responsibility to speak for them. So to the extent I've been more involved in issues about college affordability or the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, it's because I don't run away from the fact that I'm young. And I think it's nice to have some people here who, you know, are experiencing the things that I'm experiencing, two young kids at home just struggling to save for college, working through childcare dilemmas. You know, I think that's important, and hopefully I bring some of that perspective to the deliberations in the Senate.
Wait, I used to be the youngest in everything, and now I'm the oldest.
So well, I was the youngest 2 years ago, and I'm not actually the second youngest now. I'm the third youngest. Very quickly, you lose these titles, I've found. Inevitably.
We love talking to Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. Chris, when we come back the next time, I want to ask you about Saudi Arabia, okay?
Great.